Welcome to the Partially Examined Life, episode 144, part 2 of 3. This is the second half of our interview with Martha Nussbaum about her book Anger and Forgiveness. In this half, we're going to talk about social justice, about the potential role of anger in producing social change, and what role forgiveness has in all of this. If you haven't heard part 1 yet, please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and check that out first. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. The other interviewers here are Dylan Casey and Wes Alwyn. The role of rage in this sort of change has been a central issue in American civil rights. You had mentioned Martin Luther King. Well, maybe one of the ways of interpreting the Malcolm X response to that is, or even just thinking about the way that this comes up in political speech today on the internet, et cetera, is that one of the ways of calling attention to it, the concern is not so much the minorities that are being discriminated against or being insulted need to demonstrate in a, what, Booker T. Washington manner, that they are civilized and worthy of respect in the way that you were just talking about Gandhi and the Indians, but that actually expressing rage, expressing anger, making that a force in political organization. Unless you're angry about what's going on, then things stop happening. Then you end up complacent.
And in fact, isn't one function of anger, at least the display of anger there, just signaling what your values are? So the fact that you're angry indicates that you take it seriously and it matters a lot. And if you're not angry, or at least not displaying anger, you talk a little bit about the difference between these two things. But that at the very least, the display of anger would indicate that you are taking this seriously and you mean it. And in fact, on the other side, if you're not angry, you either are cold or unresponsive or you aren't properly sensitive. And in fact, being too rational in such a situation or not plainly emotional can significantly undermine the political effectiveness of what you were saying.
Yeah, well, that's what some people think. But just look at those cases. Now, the behavior of people who go out in the street and riot is not committed behavior aiming at justice. Yeah. It's ungovernable adolescent behavior. So that's what anger looks like. It looks very ungoverned, very non-goal-oriented. By contrast, the civil rights movement, it was certainly not hyper-self-protective. People were risking their lives. They did risk their lives. They risked every day their physical safety. But they did it in a way that expressed a commitment to constructive work and hope on the other side. So the message that was being sent to white Americans was, we don't want to just tear you limb from limb. What good would that do? We want to make a better world, and we're determined to do that. And we show you our determination by the quality of the risk that we're willing to run. Now, King did think that strategically non-anger was the right thing. And he says this. He says, even when violence and anger would be justified, maybe in self-defense, he's not going to do that because it will send the wrong message to white Americans. But that was not the main thing for him. The main thing is you don't create the future by kind of spurting off in all directions. You do it by an intelligent effort to create, as he says, very movingly, a world where men and women can live together. And if you listen to his speeches, you see that sometimes he allows that people are brought to the movement by their anger. Okay, that's fine. Maybe for some of them, that was a good step because they might not have gotten out of their houses if they hadn't been angry in the first. But then they have to enter what I call the transition. They have to turn away from their personal peak and they have to stop just wanting to smash. And they have to turn to the future and think, what is this world that we're making? And pointedly, he certainly drew on some aspects of the Christian tradition and not on others. There's nothing from the Book of Revelations in his speeches where, you know, sure, the Christians are very Nietzschean in that book. They're trying to just envisage the horrible torment of the powerful oppressor. But he goes to the images of hope and of peace and of coexistence. And it's very, very moving. So I think, as I do say, there are some limited instrumental roles for anger, like it might motivate you to go to a movement in the first place. It might even be a wake-up call to you that something is badly wrong. But I think in general, it's not even a good signal to society at large that something's badly wrong, a much better signal is your committed choice to risk your life and your safety for the sake of a valuable end. And you can't really demonstrate that by rioting in the streets, but something like the march. And it doesn't seem too emotionless. King was not Gandhi. Now, Gandhi, I do feel that there's something quite problematic about Gandhi because he's a true Stoic. Richard Sarabji wrote an excellent book called Gandhi and the Stoics, where he does show that Gandhi, like the Stoics, repudiates all the major emotions, including personal love, including grief, and so on. I don't like that. But King was not like that. Grief, he embraced. And so when those little girls in Birmingham died, his speech of mourning is haunting and indelible, and there's no doubt of the depth of the sorrow and the pain that had been inflicted there. But that doesn't mean he's going to go the road of payback. I just didn't mean that. And it's also true of Mandela. Mandela is certainly not a Stoic. His letters to Winnie show a person who's very capable of profound longing, of love, of sorrow, of loneliness, of grief. But again, it's the spirit of payback that they both renounce. And I think that's what won them the world's admiration. And, you know, that it should be regarded as a kind of mere coward's recourse. That seems ridiculous because they were not just facing prison, death themselves, but asking their followers to take that same risk. So I guess I think, if people do think the way you're describing, and I imagine Malcolm X, under the influence of Fanon and so on, did have some such view, but I think it's just a mistaken view, both strategically and really. One thing that you mentioned, the performance of anger, I guess I think that in some limited, low-stakes cases, there is room for a performance of anger. Mostly in the middle realm. I talk about these Utku Eskimos who are very like the Stoics in that they think that anger is never a good thing and that you should never have anger. You should always cooperate very closely, and the spirit of anger poisoned cooperation. But they do sometimes think that a performance of anger might make sense. And here's the case. So this anthropologist, Gene Briggs, who's studying them, wanted to find out whether they think that it was just angry behavior that was bad, or is it the feeling, the subjective experience of anger that's bad. So she asked them about Jesus getting angry at the money changers and throwing them out of the temple. And they said, oh, well, of course he wouldn't really be angry because he was perfect. But in that culture, that was a kind of behavior that got people's attention, that they understood. Mm-hmm. So they were validating the performance, but in a relatively low-stakes case. And I say the same thing. There's an example that I give where at the hairdresser, I was having my hair washed, and I was hit in the forehead by a bottle falling out of a cabinet way up high. And I thought, oh, this is really dangerous. And the women who worked there said, oh, yes, we've been trying to get management to fix that for months, but they just haven't done it. Well, I wasn't hurt because the bottle had nothing in it. It was a plastic bottle. But I thought somebody else might get hurt. Mm-hmm. So I did perform anger to the management because I know very well that what gets people's attention is the possibility of a lawsuit. And so I thought that if they thought I might sue them, then they would fix the lock. And they did. I think it's hard to know whether that's manipulative. I've just been presenting this material in the university in Germany, and all the students were very critical of me. They said, you're lying and you're manipulating other people. So I think the Kantian spirit of the German students made them think that there was always something a little bit wrong with that behavior. But anyway, I think you would not want to do it in a major political movement now, because you don't want to send the signal that you're in favor of this kind of ungovernable spurting out and looting and rioting and so on. People are all too ready to do that anyway.
You talked about emotion earlier as not always associated with feeling, that you could have, depending on the person, depending on the circumstances, you could have emotions that were, so maybe makes me think that one could in fact be terribly angry without being rageful. And that is probably the form in which I've heard most talked about it. Maybe this, you mentioned, I think this is associated with Aristotle, as it being a kind of machine of a source of motion, a source of motion for your own self, maybe even towards getting justice.
And I don't think that was Aristotle, but anyway. Okay, I think what I was trying to say is that when you have the emotion without the feeling, that's because the emotion itself is non-conscious. So the case of the daily fear of death is my central case. Now, I think there are anger cases like that. Like if you walk around in some way angry at your partner and you don't want to own up to it and you think, why do I have a headache all the time? And then eventually you realize. But I don't think that's very likely in the political movements, that it would be so non-conscious. But then once it's conscious, I think you typically do have all the subjective experience associated with it.
Well, just to connect up the middle realm back with this, the social justice stuff, we've already said generally the perceived insults that you get on a daily basis, whether inadvertent or deliberate, are things that you would take the stoic tack on. They're not worth getting upset about. But you also address in the book, you're in traffic, you cut somebody else off and they call you a jerk, they give you the finger, whatever. Like, that's not worth getting mad at them about for their perceived slight against you. However, if they call you a racist slur or a sexist slur, it seems like, again, from the social justice standpoint, that there needs to be at least a display. Maybe this is not the best particular example if I've just cut somebody off. But, you know, some way of saying that language is not acceptable under any circumstances. What you're doing is exhibiting the symptom of a larger problem that I need to say something to address.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think that you've picked up something very important that I think we should spend time on. And that is that there's one status that I think is of such moment that we should always think of it as a central social good, and that is equal human dignity. And so when somebody wrongs you with respect to your equal human dignity, we shouldn't just let that go by. Now, what we should do is complicated. Some people think hate speech laws are a good idea, group libel. I'm not in favor of that for complicated reasons. But, I mean, I agree with you entirely that we shouldn't just let that go. And so we should pause, we should underline that, we should say this is outrageous and it shouldn't happen again. We should try to figure out why it happened and how to not make that happen again. And in an academic institution, I think we could certainly make rules against that kind of speech. It's very tricky. Free speech in the academy, I don't think we should get meshed in because there's so many different views of how wide the latitude for uncivil and damaging speech should be in the academy. But I think no one would disagree that racist and sexist speech is a problem, that we should all flag it, draw it to people's attention, say this is really bad, it's not creating the kind of community that we want. I don't know whether performing anger is a good idea, though. I don't see any reason why it would be. See, I think anger, because it's so associated with payback, motivates people who are like those managers in the hairdresser. That is that they're worried about a very specific kind of payback, namely the lawsuit. If you say to people, no racist speech, I think what's more important is to communicate that norm to everyone, to just say this is the kind of community we want to have. And I think performing anger makes people personalize it too much. It wouldn't get the right message across. At least that's what I'm inclined to think right now.
Yeah, I guess I'm just restating what you've said before, which is that this very limited function of anger, even to the extent that it motivates or gets you out of the house, is the word used, transitional. It's that from there, the motivation of the action is not based upon anger, because as you've analyzed it, anger is understood as in terms of payback.
Yeah. In a person who's acting well, it will be at most this temporary phase. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, not everyone is acting well.
Sure.
And there's a third role that I said anger could play instrumentally. Namely, it could scare people and make them treat you well because they're afraid of an explosion. Now, there's certainly people in every university, every workplace, anywhere. There are people that we know are likely to explode. And people tiptoe around them. They don't want to upset them. But, you know, is that the best way of getting good treatment? Probably not. And if people are like that, I think in the end, They just get isolation rather than the good treatment they want because people just don't want to talk to them. They're just too afraid of what will happen.
Mm-hmm. All right. The social critique of anger has been fairly straightforward, that there's a couple of central irrational parts in the cognitive mechanism of anger, both the payback bit and the status bit. But forgiveness, you say the problems with this are much more subtle. I mean, it ends up being very much the same sort of Nietzschean critique that you might have thought that your anger was righteous or that your demand for forgiveness was righteous, but underlyingly, it's a lot more hostile and has more negative consequences than you might have thought. But you feel the need to go and give a very Nietzschean genealogical account in the book.
Yes, I mean, it was here that I really felt I had to do something more genealogical because forgiveness is an artifact of a religious system or systems that people don't always hold today. Some do, some don't. But they have appropriated the kind of cut-off trunk of this system without actually appropriating the whole system. So we have to look at what the system was like when it was whole, and then we have to ask, do we want this little bit of it today? So, of course, forgiveness was mainly the job of an almighty and unerring God. And so mortals are way below when they commit sins. They have to beg and grovel, and they have to promise not to do it again. So I go through both Jewish and Christian texts on this and look at what I call transactional forgiveness, which is really the most common type. It's what philosophers today say is the central type of forgiveness. Charles Griswold has an excellent book on forgiveness, and that's his account of what the main type of forgiveness is. Namely, the wronged party agrees to waive the angry feelings in return for a certain humility, a confession of wrongdoing, a promise not to do it again, etc., etc., etc. Now, transfer that to the realm of human relations, and it looks pretty hostile because it's basically not saying, okay, I'll let this go. It's saying something much more complicated. It's saying, I will let my anger go only if you perform this kind of humiliating performance. And we see, I think, all the time when people are getting divorced, when people, let's say, politicians who have cheated on their spouses are on TV, there's this very unseemly performance that people go through, which is very humiliating, which is a, oh, please, please forgive me. And then the other one says, oh, yes, I will forgive you if you promise to be a different kind of person, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, that's not the only thing that we call forgiveness. So that's why it gets so complicated. If you look at the Gospels, there are really, I think, three different things that Jesus says. One of them is certainly that is, you should forgive your enemies only if they engage in this renunciation of sin. And that part is what the organized church has taken up in large part, and that's not surprising because the organized church wants to have a powerful role in forgiving sin. But there's another type that's unconditional, that it says, I forgive you without attaching to it any particular condition. And Jesus says that kind of thing too. Well, that's a lot better, except why were you angry in the first place? So it's better if we admit that it was okay for you to be angry. Well, then that looks a little bit better for you to forgive unconditionally. But on the other hand, it still adopts a position of moral superiority. So we notice that leaders, particularly, I would say, Mandela, he never used the word forgive because it did have these connotations of the other party being below you or groveling, even if you don't say so. And indeed, Desmond Tutu understands the Truth and Reconciliation Commission theoretically. I mean, his kind of summary chapter says that it's this form of transactional forgiveness. So anyway, unconditional forgiveness is better than transactional forgiveness, but it has problems. But then there's something else, namely, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. And the parable of the prodigal son, I think, expresses that attitude. Namely, the father just has this unconditional love for his son. The son is coming back. We don't have any idea. The father certainly doesn't have any idea whether the son is going to apologize, whether he's going to change his life. But he was lost, and now he's found. And so the father sees him coming a long way off, and the text says his guts were heaved up. He had this very powerful surge of emotion, and he runs to embrace his child. Now, of course, that's not incompatible with saying, you know, you did some bad things and you better change your life and so on. But the first impulse is one of love, unconditional love. So that's what I prefer, is a kind of generosity that gets ahead of the moral blame and the moral advice. And I do think that that's what certainly Mandela, and I would say also King, exemplified. It's just a very generous spirit that says we're not going to do bean counting of wrongs. We're going to move ahead in a spirit of brotherhood. King was very clear that it doesn't mean you have to like those people or make them your bosom buddies. It just means love in the biblical sense of agape, the kind of willed love that's the opposite of hate. Mandela was even maybe a little further, because he liked to actually form relationships of friendship with the former dominating Afrikaners, and he was so good at doing it. He was very funny, he was very endearing, and he inspired a kind of relaxation and ease that made it possible for him to form personal friendships even with the former leaders of South African security, even with the captain of the rugby team, and so forth. But anyway, all I'm talking about is love in the more will-oriented sense, and a kind of generosity. We're not going to engage in constant retributive bean counting. We're just going to move ahead. So those are the three attitudes. And I think if we're thinking about a world that we're in, that is a world where we're not modeling our behavior on some particular God. I mean, some of us are theists and some are not. And some among the theists might think of God as that kind of retributive God. I'm a proud Reformed Jew, and I don't think that the retributive God is the right picture of God. I think the right picture of God would be a much more loving God. So anyway, if we were theists, we might have this view or that view. But since we live together in a multi-religious and partly secular society, we better not base our moral attitudes on any one religious picture, and we better try to find one that doesn't express, and I think here Nietzsche was absolutely brilliant, this concealed spirit of revenge that comes from the desire to play God toward other people.
So before we go on, let's hear a word from our sponsors. The first one we want to talk about is Blue Apron, a service where you can order meals online with fresh, high-quality ingredients. They are delivered right to you instead of having to go shopping for them. They come with recipe cards. And I've actually did this for more than a year, and when I'm in a situation to do it again, I'm definitely going to start doing it again. And Dylan, you recently just tried this.
I've been cooking for a long time. I like cooking a lot. And what drew me to Blue Apron was being able to have meals ready to be prepared right away. There's a lot of overhead for shopping, and it made a difference to be able to have everything delivered in a box. And I found it totally awesome. The food was really high quality. It was at least as good as what I would have picked up myself at a really good farmer's market or grocery store. And the recipes themselves were fun to try. They were very simple to do. When I was signed up, I was able to pick out the kind of food, whether I wanted to have meat in it or vegetarian. I made a creamy shrimp fettuccine, which was some fresh beans in it, and the fettuccine was right there, and fresh pasta. It was delicious.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience, and I've actually, before we even got the SAT campaign, I was turning people on to Blue Apron left and right, and everyone seemed to be as happy with it as me. And I was in a different situation. I don't like to cook. I always found it frustrating, and the results were never that good, and then I hate shopping. And part of it was just a matter of ignorance. So over a course of a year, I got a lot of experience cooking with Blue Apron and became more comfortable with it. In a way, it was like having a cooking course kind of delivered to me. It ends up being less than $10 a meal.
There's some meals available in August. Spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. Summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplants, shishoto peppers, and corn. and chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. Those are just three examples of the meals.
Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/PEL.
You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/PEL.
Hey, folks. You know, every week we get an email from somebody who's asking us how to start up a philosophy podcast, or they want to start up their own philosophy blog. One of the first things we tell them is that if you've got a great idea, then you need to make sure you've got a great distinctive name like The Partially Examined Life. And if you've got that great distinctive name, then you need to go out and register the domain name for it. Well, fortunately, we got a new sponsor starting this week, Hover. And Hover has made it ridiculously easy to find that perfect domain name. So, of course, they make it easy to search and see if that distinctive name of yours has already been registered. But here's something else cool that they do. They have over 400 domain extensions that you can use in your name. So, of course, they have all the classics like .com and .net. They offer niche extensions like .design and .tech. Well, I went ahead and searched through, and I found that they also have .academy, .capital, and .paris. So if you wanted, you could go out there and register Plato's .academy, Marx and Engels' das.capital, or Jacques Brel is alive and well and living in .paris. Folks, I want you to find a distinctive domain name for your idea. Go to hover.com and use the promo code PELIFE, PEL Life, at checkout to save 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com and use the promo code PELIFE at checkout to save 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, one more thing. It's not too late to sign up for the drawing to win a copy of Martha Nussbaum's book. We will accept entries through August 10th. There are two ways to enter. You can go to our Facebook page. You can like the page and like the post. And like the post for this episode. We'll be drawing one of our copies from that pool. We'll be drawing three copies from the pool of PEL citizens. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Sign up to be a recurring supporter. One of those copies will be reserved for a new citizen, drawn only from that very small group of people who sign up right now. So your chances are good. Now let's get back to the interview. As with anger, we're looking at if there is a role for some form of forgiveness, then it has to be forward-looking, and this is going to play out differently in the three different realms, right?
Yeah.
That if you've got a personal betrayal, for instance, you can't simply let them off the hook. If a continued betrayal along the same lines will mean that it's not going to be a real relationship anymore,
right.
You need some sort of hoop jumping. You can't simply say, unconditional love, that's being a doormat, right?
Well, I think, you know, it doesn't mean you're going to stay in that same relationship. You might decide this relationship isn't working and I'm just going to change it. But that doesn't mean payback. And I think a lot of people think that it does, and it's often because they feel weak and helpless. And I think that's particularly true, as I said before, of women who have no strong independent career, whose only life was as part of a couple. And so now they can't imagine what life could be without that relationship. But if you've been betrayed, well, then you might think, does this relationship make sense going forward? Is there a way of making it better? But if not, that doesn't mean you have to pay the person back. And actually, I have to say from my own experience that the relationship with an ex-husband or an ex-lover can actually be a wonderful relationship, because very often you can make a new friendship with somebody which isn't plagued by whatever problems made the relationship difficult in the first place. You know, you can avoid those things, and then you can have the good without the bad. But politically, what it really means is that you, going forward, you need people's cooperation. And this is true whether you're king trying to make a more just America. He needed white Americans to be on his side. It also means if you're Nelson Mandela, even if you're 90%, let's face it, a lot of technical knowledge, a lot of legal knowledge, a lot of very important social capital was wrapped up in the Afrikaner community. So if you just banish them to outer darkness, that would be very stupid. And Mandela was not the wisest chooser of his own cabinet in every respect, but he certainly understood that point, that if you alienate the people who, let's say, control the security services, the people who control the police, the people who control the army. That's a stupid thing to do because they have knowledge and expertise that you need. The day that he died, well, the day of his funeral, I was watching CNN International, and there was this policeman, by now a leading officer, and he was remembering that on that day in 1994 when Mandela was being inaugurated president and the procession was moving through the streets, Mandela stopped before a group of young police recruits, and he got down from his presidential car, and he shook everyone's hand, and he said, "Our trust depends on you." And he was expressing to these young men, who of course were not fixed, that he wanted their cooperation, he respected them, he wanted their expertise, he wanted their friendship. And this, by now much older man, was openly weeping at the memory of Mandela. So, you know, people can change, but they're certainly not going to change if your first act is to say, bad, bad, bad. It's like being a parent. You don't bring up children. At least most people today know that you don't bring up children by constantly rubbing their nose in the bad things they've done. You don't even train animals that way, for heaven's sake. We now know that positive reinforcement is much more effective in training all kinds of animals, from elephants to dolphins, than negative reinforcement. So what you want to do is to form friendship. And you do that much more through the kind of unconditional generosity that Mandela showed so beautifully.
Wes or Dylan, do you have any follow-ups about forgiveness?
I thought Martha summarized very well.
An additional point, how you want something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to go. And I've just been asked this morning to write a statement about the process in Colombia. I was just there in December, and so I have some good friends there, and they want me to write something about the reconciliation process there. So I have to think what I'm going to say. But I guess I think it's very important going forward to have accountability of some sort. Now, sometimes that involves criminal trials, and there might be cases in which the legal system is operating well, and you think the perpetrators, it's only bringing them into court that's going to give you the kind of accountability you need. That might have been the case with Nuremberg, only the problem with Nuremberg was that it was so one-sided. It was really a case of victor's justice. But anyhow, you need to create a record of accountability in order to say our society or our international society stands for certain values and we don't accept transgressions of that. And going forward, we commit ourselves to saying we don't want that kind of stuff. Now, sometimes having a criminal trial is stupid. And that's what the people in South Africa decided, because they realized that the people who were guilty of all these wrongs were mostly wealthy and middle class, and they would retain powerful lawyers who would argue their case well. And then we would never know who did what. So the reason that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission offered amnesty in exchange for truth was a very simple contextual reason, namely, we really need the truth, because only a historical record of who did what will help us to move forward and give us the accountability we need. But we won't get truth if we have trials. Okay, but that's not always the case, and sometimes you do want criminal trials. Now, I think, though, sometimes people think they can leap over the truth part of it and just move to the future without that. And Northern Ireland is, I'm afraid, it's sort of like that, where there are all kinds of essential facts about what happened that are not part of the public record. And not only that, but they are known. So there's this sealed archive at Boston College, which has in it all this testimony about what happened. It's not going to be released until everyone is dead, who is even mentioned in the tapes. Well, that seems to me the worst of both worlds. That is, the truth is there and everyone knows it's there, but they can't get it. And so whether indeed Gerry Adams was an accomplice in the kidnapping and death of Jean McConville, we don't know. And we know that we might know in like 30 years, but it's only after Gerry Adams is dead. So, of course, people hate that. And it makes it much harder to have reconciliation. And I've heard people there say, you know, Martin McGuinness, we know what he did. he killed Mountbatten relatives and so on. And it would have been understandable. It was understandable when Prince Philip refused to shake his hand, but it's also maybe more generous for Queen Elizabeth to shake his hand, and she did, and so on. Now, with Gerry Adams, the problem is we don't even know how to move beyond what he did because we don't know what he did. So I think that's a good example to ponder for countries that are thinking of going through this. At least you don't want to do that sealed archive thing. If there is testimony, we need to have it on the table, or we need it to have it become accessible so that the world can deal with it and then move on, as they did with Martin McGuinness. So I think every country has to make its decisions contextually and in terms of its own resources, its own particular problems, but accountability and then moving on in a spirit of generosity. Those are the two things that I would say are important.
And central to the accountability is the transparency of truth.
Yeah. I mean, I think I see why they did that, because Gerry Adams was a crucial political player. And I think probably people know, I mean, this is the problem. Everyone sort of thinks that he was probably guilty. Well, I guess I think they made the wrong gamble, because if they had just let it be out on the table, as with Martin McGuinness, then, okay, he was guilty, we move on. Mandela was a violent revolutionary, and everyone knew that. And then we move on. And Gerry Adams, like Mandela, used violent tactics for a time and then moved to a period of reconciliation. So I guess I think they were excessively nervous and fearful that knowing what he did would just torpedo the whole reconciliation. It's probably not the case, and better to have the truth there.
Well, in fact, it seems like you're arguing that the absence of that truth undermines trust, yeah, which is the fundamental piece for going forward. So the piece of forgiveness that you hold on to that seems to lack the payback part and lack the humiliation part is, you say the word accountability, but you mean that not in the sense of balancing accounts, but right, in the sense of establishing what was done, laying out the transparency of it. And the word we would normally use would be confess. But you also don't like that word as well, because it involves too much notion of humiliation or self-prostration.
Right. Yeah.
And so you described the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and I had a hard time imagining going through that on either side and it not feeling like a confession. It made sense to me on the one hand that what was central to it working was the transparency of it, and that the fundamental piece of going forward was acknowledgement of what was done and people acknowledging that they had done it. And I guess the mechanism for removing the humiliation from it was to involve the amnesty.
Well, I think there were several things. The first was, like, the amnesty certainly played a part. You're not going to be thrown in some terrible prison the way they threw Mandela. Second part is the way they behaved. They behaved with respect. They were careful, I think, or at least they tried to be, to treat everyone fairly and equally. But more important even than that was that they were not partisan, in the sense that when crimes were committed by the Black Africans, they too came before the commission. Winnie Mandela came before the commission. And that, I mean, not just any old Black African, but Winnie Mandela, that inspired a lot of public trust, because we're just not playing favorites. We're not exercising victor's justice. See, I think what everyone sees Nuremberg from the American point of view, at least even Germans, I think, because they're so guilty, they have such spurious pseudo-guilt, that they kind of think, oh, Nuremberg was great because we were able to be convicted and our guilt was pinned on us and so on. But actually, I think there was a lot wrong with Nuremberg, because they did not think about how the Allies had committed war crimes, which they certainly did. They did not try them for the bombing of Dresden and all kinds of things. So I think the even-handedness of the whole thing is really important.
So we've brought up guilt a few times, and I'm thinking this maybe should be our final topic here. We've been talking so far, whether as a society or as individuals, to become well, maybe better Stoics in some cases, but emotionally more mature individuals. It'd be great if we could abandon anger, at least the pointless, self-destructive, irrational kinds of anger. It'd be great if we could not require prostration of people before forgiving them, or even, you suggest, just abandon the notion of forgiveness altogether and just unconditional love. And the common thing is, of course, looking forward rather than dwelling on the past. But switching this to the perspective of the person that has done wrong. So there's a section on this, anger at oneself, in the intimate relationships section. And you say, well, guilt can be well-grounded. Obviously, if these people have committed war crimes or personal affronts, thinking of Raskolnikov, Crime and Punishment here. It seems if you want to be consistent, you'd have to say, well, the best thing that such a person can do, of course, they're going to suffer lots of, well, I was going to say, hopefully, if they're well-functioning, they will suffer a lot of ill feeling about how things have gone done. You want them, of course, to recognize, not to be self-deceiving about what they've done, but ideally, they too should be forward-looking. How can I make myself into a kind of person that won't do this kind of thing again? How can I make the world a better place so other people don't? Look at why I committed this thing. What circumstances drove me to that? Can I work socially to keep other people out of that sort of trap that I was in that brought me to that? I mean, is that the solution here, or is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it very nicely. Guilt, like anger, can have this good cousin, which we could call transition guilt, which is as you described. That is to say, I'm pained at what I did, but now I'm going to turn forward and ask, how could that not happen again? And of course, it would be even better if it could not happen on the part of other people too, if I could do something for society in general. But often the distinction between the actor and the deed is lost sight of, and people think, oh, I've done that bad thing, I am bad, I am sullied. And then they inflict payback on themselves. This is encouraged by a lot of our religious upbringing. If we're Christian or Jewish, the idea that sin is lodged inside of you and the only thing you can do is continually flagellate yourself. I think it's particularly encouraged, and I talk about this in the third chapter on forgiveness, by the common Christian, particularly Christian, thought that our sexual nature itself is a site of sin, because then that makes it just, that's who I am, I can't get rid of it, I can't be anything different. And so then you feel, well, the thing I did is a part of who I am, and I better just flagellate myself unendurably. Do you know George Orwell's essay about his English boarding school experience, Such Were the Joys?
It was introduced to it by your book.
Ah. Well, so poor little Orwell, 8 years old, goes off to boarding school, and he wets the bed, and he does so repeatedly. Well, that's a part of his body. He doesn't know how to help it. And so the teachers, the authorities, say, you did this bad thing, and that means that you are bad. And poor little Orwell felt that he was just unredeemably bad, because he had no, absolutely no way of changing this. So that's the bad kind of guilt. Now, of course, in this case, it's not about a wrong at all, but that makes it even worse. But even when it is a genuine wrong, to feel that there's this indelible mark of badness in you, and that often is what we tend to do as communities. We make people, we brand them as a certain type of bad person. But the best kind of guilt toward oneself would be like the best kind of reformatory criminal justice. I describe John Braithwaite's work with juvenile justice, where he takes these teenage offenders and he has this group, the whole community talks to them, and they say, you know, you did that bad thing, but if anyone says, oh, Johnny's a bad boy, Braithwaite always says, no, he's not. He's a good person, but he made a bad mistake, and he had better not do that again. So separating the doer from the deed with the self, too, that's the key. But it's really, really hard. And, of course, it's harder still if you're brought up on these religious fictions of original badness and so on.
Some kinds of deeds seem to be amenable to that. They seem to be easier to separate out the deed from the doer. Petty theft. Or circumstances. Other deeds seem to be tied to being war. And one of the sort of the underlying features of your account really understands the malleability of the human being, right. And that we're really becoming creatures rather than being creatures.
Yeah.
And yeah. Do you think that that's the focus of organized religion, on our beingness as opposed to our becomingness is the root of this?
Well, look, organized religion comes in many different types. And as I said, I'm a proud member of a temple that thinks that what we should be doing most of the time is working for social justice. So there are many kinds of religion. And I particularly admired that church in Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. where the people were wronged in the most horrendous way. But what they all said is, well, they either said, I am ready to get rid of my anger, or one woman said, well, I feel very angry, but I know that I'm a work in progress, and I'm trying to surmount that. So the idea of struggling against the things in oneself that are really damaging. So I think we all have struggles. And sure, some things are perhaps easier not to do than others. I don't even know which ones those are, actually. I think we think, for example, that pedophilia is absolutely not remediable, but actually the evidence is that that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like anything like the sex offender registry that suggests that for the rest of your life, you are this dangerous person and there, mm-hmm. you've now served your sentence, which we assigned to you for reasons of perhaps incapacitation or specific deterrence. But now we're going to punish you for life because we think you're still this bad kind of person. So I don't like that. And I think for most sex crimes, it's really, really stupid because a lot of people who are on it are just on it for things that are eminently deterrable and controllable, such as not having sex with an underage girl, statutory rape, or things like exposing yourself in public urination. But even with pedophilia, where there's a lot of dispute about how much recidivism there is, but the accent should be on saying these deeds are bad, so you are on notice that you better not engage in those deeds. But the person is not the same thing as the deeds.
The real reform that you point to would seem to point to a whole other book on how it's so contrary to the way our penal system works in this country and the way in which we even think about the interaction of political life and economic life along with education, nutrition, and as you point out, it's so contrary.
Well, I see movement. I mean, mass incarceration now, both Republicans and Democrats believe that that's really stupid. And it's so fascinating that with drugs, where we used to think, oh, those are evil characters, the drug addict, and then just think that throwing those people in jail for as long as possible was a good idea. Now, when the addicts are white, it has changed. And I mean, I don't like the fact that there's this epidemic of opiate addiction in the poor white community. But what it is bringing about is a reexamination of our whole attitude toward drug offenses. Should these things even be illegal at all? Shouldn't the main thing be treatment and prevention rather than this punitive attitude? And I think it is happening very rapidly that all of a sudden we want police to carry antidotes to heroin overdose. We want them to help people rather than throwing them out as useless refuse. So, I mean, it's too bad it took something that happened to the white community for that change to happen. But I hope that the benefits of it will be felt by everyone.
Well, I think we are about out of time. So, geez, I knew you would not have any trouble talking right up until the last minute.
Well, this is so much fun and your questions were so great. So it is really a lot of fun. So tell me a little more about what happens next. So you'll post it, and if people want to ask me something further, they'll just email me. Is that what happens?
There will be a blog post that is the way that we deliver the actual podcast episode that people can comment on. We'll also post it to Facebook, and often people respond to that. So certainly there will be locations that we can give you the links to.
Okay. Well, I'm not on Facebook. I'm one of these antediluvian people who doesn't belong to any social media. So they will have to email me if they want to get me, but they can talk to each other on Facebook.
Yes.
So thank you very much. I enjoyed this a great deal.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. And I trust Dylan did not break any of the elephants in your
office. No. No, they loved him, and they're looking at him with great friendliness. And in fact, there's one who's sleeping and resting. And so I guess he had a very sort of restful effect.
Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hey, so that was our interview with Martha, but we have some more to talk about. So please come back for part 3 or become a Partially Examined Life citizen and get the whole thing as part of the Citizen Edition, unbroken, ad-free, right now. See you later.